We heard Billie Holiday, and before that, we heard Ben Webster. It's about 14 minutes to 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY FM in Philadelphia. By the way, at 4 o'clock, when we continue the Marion McPartland Piano Jazz Series, her guest will be pianist Hank Jones. And at 3:30, Judy Stein will be here to review museum and gallery shows around town. Well, I have a very special guest with me now, short story writer Grace Paley. I just want to quote what writer Donald Barthelme once said about her. Grace Paley is a wonderful writer and troublemaker. We are fortunate to have her in our country. I like that. Her volumes of short stories are The Little Disturbances of Man, first published in 1959, and Enormous Changes at the Last Minute, published in 1975. Recently, her short stories have been appearing in The New Yorker. She's been a Guggenheim Fellow and is now teaching at Sarah Lawrence College, and she's been active for many years in peace causes and feminist issues. She's in town today as a guest writer for a special course at Temple University Center City. I asked Grace Paley if when she came she'd read one of her stories for us, and she said that she would. So, Grace Paley, welcome to Fresh Air, and I'd love it if you could start by reading one of your stories.
Okay, good. I will. This story isn't in either of my books. It's been published since then. It's called Love, and here it is. First, I wrote this poem. Walking up the slate path of the college park under the nearly full moon, the brown oak leaves are red as maples, and I have been looking at the young people. They speak and embrace one another. Because of them, I thought I would descend into remembering love. So I let myself down, hand over hand, until my feet touched the earth of the gardens of Vesey Street. I told my husband, I've just written a poem about love. What a good idea, he said. Then he told me about Sally Johnson on Lake Winnipesaukee, who was 12 and a half when he was 14. Then he told me about Rosemary Johansson on Lake Sunapee. Then he told me about Jane Marston in Concord High. Then he told me about Mary Smythe of Radcliffe when he was a poet at Harvard. Then he told me about two famous poets, one fair and one dark, both now dead, when he was a secret poet working at an acceptable trade in an office without windows. When at last he came to my time, that is, the past 15 years or so, he told me about Dottie Wasserman. Hold on, I said. What do you mean, Dottie Wasserman? She's a character in a book. She's written about. She's not even a person. Okay, he said. And what's Vesey Street? What's that? Well, it's nothing special. I used to be in love with a guy who was a shrub buyer. Vesey Street was the downtown garden center of the city when the city still had wonderful centers of commerce. I used to walk the kids there when they were little carriage babies, half asleep, maybe take the ferry to Hoboken. Years later, I'd bike down there Sundays, ride around and around. I even saw him three times. No kidding, said my husband. How come I don't know the guy? Ugh, the stupidity of the beloved. It's you, I said. Anyway, what's this baloney about you and Dottie Wasserman? Nothing much. She was this crazy kid who hung around the bars, but she didn't drink. Really, it was for the men, you know. Neither did I drink too much, I mean. I was just hoping to get laid once in a while, or maybe meet someone and fall madly in love. He is that romantic. Sometimes I wonder if loving me in this homey life, in middle age, with two sets of bedroom slippers, one a skin of sandal for summer and the other pair lined with cozy sheepskin, it must be a disappointing experience for him. He made a polite bridge over my conjectures. He said, she was also this funny mother in the park, years later, when we were all doing that municipal politics and I was married to Josephine. Dottie and I were both delegates to that famous Kansas City National Meeting of Town Meetings, NMTM, remember? Some woman. No, I said, that's not true. She was made up, just plain invented and put in a book in the late 50s. Oh, he said, then it was after that. I must have met her afterward. He is stubborn, so I dropped the subject and went on to get the groceries. Our shrinking family requires more coffee, more eggs, more cheese, less butter, less meat, less orange juice, more grapefruit. Walking along the street, encountering no neighbor, I hummed a little up and down tune and continued jostling time with the help of my nice reconnoitering brain. Here I was, experiencing the old earth of Vesey Street, breathing in and out with more attention to the process than is usual in the late morning. All because of love, probably. How interesting the way it glides to solid invented figures from true remembered wraiths. By God, I thought, the lover is real. The heart of the lover continues. It has been propagandized from birth. I passed our local bookstore, which was doing well with the joy of all sex underpinning its prosperity. The owner gave me, a dependable customer of poorly advertised books, an affectionate smile. He was a great success. He didn't know that 3 years later his rent would be tripled, he would become a sad failure, and the landlord, feeling himself brilliant, an outwitting entrepreneur, a star in the microeconomic heavens, he would be the famous success. From half a block away, I could see the kale in the grocer's bin, crumbles of ice shining the dark leaves. In interior counter view, I imagined my husband's northern country fields, the late autumn frost and the curly green. I began to mumble a new poem. In the grocer's bin, the green kale shines. In the north country, it stands sweet with frost, dark and curly, in a garden of tan hay and light white snow. Light white. I said that a couple of questioning times. Suddenly, my outside eyes saw a fine-looking woman named Margaret, who hadn't spoken to me in 2 years. We'd had many years of political agreement before some matters relating to the Soviet Union separated us. In the angry months during which we were both right in many ways, she took away with her to her political position and daily friendship my own best friend, Louise, my lifelong Park, PTA, and anti-war movement sister, Louise. In a hazy litter of love and leafy green vegetables, I saw Margaret's good face, and before I remembered our serious difference, I smiled. At the same moment, she knew me and smiled. So foolish is the true lover when responded to, that I took her hand as we passed, bent to it, pressed it to my cheek, and touched it with my lips. I described all this to my husband at supper time. He was happy to explain everything. The smile was for Margaret, he said. But you know, you miss Louise a lot. And the kiss was for Louise. We both said, ah. Then we talked over the way the SALT Treaty looked more like a floor than a ceiling, read a poem written by one of his daughters, looked at a TV show telling the destruction of the European textile industry, and then made love. In the morning, he said, you're some lover. You know, he said, you really are. You remind me a lot of Dottie Wasserman.
Oh, thanks for reading that, Grace. My guest is Grace Paley. The story she just read was published in The New Yorker. It seems to me that not many people are short story writers anymore, that most writers write novels or poems, and the short story almost seems to be a dying form sometimes. How did you decide to write short stories? You don't write novels, do you?
Well, in the first place, it's not a dying form, but we can go into that later. And, I mean, it's not at all a dying form. It's true that the places that it's published are getting fewer and fewer and skimpier and so forth. But there are really, there are wonderful short story writers writing right now in many different methods and modes and forms and approaches, you know. As for myself, I wrote poetry most of my life, and then so that when I began to write, I just sort of naturally began to write with a short story, which after all you finish sooner than you finish a novel, like a poem. Also, I had small kids, and that meant a lot of distracting time. And I mean, I say this with hindsight. I didn't say to myself, things are so distractible. I can only write short stories. I wrote short stories because things were distracting.
All your characters seem to be people that you know, but I wonder, in fact, how much of your stories and your people are actually drawn from real life.
Well, you do know something. You don't. Very few people start with something they don't know. But the really great thing about writing is that one of the reasons you write is really to because you're pressed to consider and think about and try to understand what you don't know about what you know, so that you begin with some people you know, but there's so much you don't know, and that's what you really are dealing with, and that's the only interesting thing. If you know it all, then it's pretty boring to put it down, you know.
You have an incredible facility for dialogue and for capturing what sounds like real dialogue, but more so, because most of the people have really special eccentricities in their speech. that you have.
Well,
in
I don't think that's really so. Gee, now I've disagreed with you twice. if you really look at it, a lot of the people really, really say the drabbest things. But I don't have them going on for hours with those drab things. I mean, that some of the people speaking in, well, the storyteller usually has an interesting way of speaking because the storyteller is the storyteller, you know, and speaks. And that's different from the general run of characters. But the fact of the matter is that people speak very well. I mean, it's really people, when people want to tell you something, when somebody wants to tell you something, that person speaks usually in a way that brings together all her or his feelings about language and character and the world that's screwing them, or you know, or whatever it is. Or if a child, you know, if a young person tells you something about their life with their family, they will tell an old person. Anybody will really tell you. If it's something they want to tell, they'll tell it well, mostly.
Can I ask you to read a paragraph? I just love this paragraph, and to me, it's an example of how you make people sound like you'd expect someone to sound, but they're. It sounds so good that you know that there's a brilliant writer at work here. It's the second paragraph.
Can you just
read
Rosie?
It? Yeah. Can you read that for us?
Poor Rosie. If there was more life in my little sister, she would know my heart is a regular college of feelings, and there is such information between my corset and me that our whole married life is a kindergarten. I read it to you with an accent. The woman who tells it has a sort of Russian Yiddish accent.
Well, that's great. I mean, and I don't... it captures something really special about the person speaking, but it's probably better written than they could ever really talk.
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, I would say, let's put it this way, because the artist really has a job to do, that which is to bring it all together. But any particular sentence in here, it seems to me that this particular woman would really be able to... could have thought of something like this, could have talked like that. A lot of it is her whole married life is a kindergarten, things like that. I really very, I grew up in a household that spoke three languages, English, Yiddish, and Russian, and most Russian and English the most, and Yiddish less. But it seems to me those languages were very colorful. I've been living in Vermont, and if you really spend time listening to the people up there talk, they really have their own idiom that's very strong. And the thing is to listen to it and bring it together in that way. So I mean, I'm not trying to say that everybody speaks like a absolute ethnic convention or anything like that, but there is within a folk language like Yiddish, you know, and when people bring those languages into English, they really do very marvelous things with them. And
but they're frequently embarrassed by what they say because they don't think it's marvelous themselves. Yeah. Like a lot of Yiddish people are, a lot of people who speak Yiddish are very embarrassed by their English.
Oh, and yeah, well, people are.
Do you think that you're living in Vermont now? Do you think that you would ever get familiar enough with the Vermont way of speaking to be able to write about Vermont people?
Well, when you talk about dialogue, I think I'd like to just say one thing about it, that any writer is a listener. I mean, it's one of the reasons, one of many reasons that a writer becomes a writer is they happen to have, even if they were a very gabby kid, you know, and always talking a lot and being a pest like some, at the same time, they were also people who really listened a lot. I think Muriel Rukeyser said any writer is a writer is a little girl or boy who sat under the piano or the dresser or the table listening to the grown-ups. And you see those kids now, and I know those kids are going to do something with language. They're listening all the time. That's one of the so there's that listening because it's interesting. You know, it's interesting. It's life. It's the world. Then the writing comes, and at this point, people just give up too quickly. I mean, I'm not saying that anybody can do it, but I think almost anybody that really wants to get it right can do it. You know, who's anybody who's been listening a lot, and who will be willing to read their their sentences or their dialogue over and over to themselves. I mean, for a long, you know, all day, and maybe for several days, really will get it. It's all in your ear. If you're a listener, if you're not a listener, nothing will help. I mean, that means you're not interested, so who cares?
I wonder if dialect isn't a little bit like music. Like, some people just play jazz and wouldn't really be able to make a go of classical music. I was wondering, like, if, you know, Vermont speech and New York speeches may be comparable in any way.
Mm, no, I think if you hear people talk, you hear people talk. But it's work. It has nothing. Nothing's done without great labor.
I think of you as being such a city person. From reading your stories, which are usually set in places like New York, do you have to make mental adjustments when you live in
Vermont? Well, I haven't written any country stories, so I probably will continue to write them. I mean, I've written a few articles about it, about living up there, but I haven't done too much. Some poems, but really.
Do you feel out of place? Do you like it?
No, it's just like, it's village life. It's just like living in a neighborhood in New York or probably Philadelphia or any place. It's a neighborhood, and it's a... If you think of it as a neighborhood, not a little teeny town, and that you have to, it's much like that.
You teach writing courses now?
I teach a writing class, yeah.
What are some of the suggestions you make frequently to your students, some of the common problems you find in their writing?
Well, a lot of young people really write, don't really write from themselves too much. I mean, they are really so so self-concerned. And of course, a lot of work starts like that. I certainly started that way. You know, it seemed to me that I only wanted to tell the world how I felt about certain things. And in a way, that's one of the places that for me poetry came from. And it wasn't until I began to really want the world to speak to me that that I began to write stories, and that's what I've tried to do. Is get one of the things I've tried to do is get the world to speak, and so that I'm interested in getting students to make a long, long stretch towards another person, and to really try to speak in that voice sometimes, and often if it's a person with whom they've had some sort of conflict. The stretch is extreme, and as I'm speaking into this microphone, I'm pulling my arm out as far as I can, and that's the stretch, and that makes for a lot of tension and interest, and it really the shoulder is the knowing, and what you stretch towards is the not knowing, and so that's one of the things that I think it's useful for people to do, young or old. And that doesn't mean they shouldn't also do all the kinds of writing about their own immediate lives that they want to. But there's a lot of that, and I'm sort of interested in the way in which the artist really speaks not only for herself or himself, but really for a class of persons or a group of persons or a sex of persons, it speaks for people who aren't maybe speaking for themselves.
Well, you've been very active in peace work and in feminist issues. Do you feel like literature is a good consciousness-raising tool to really go out and make statements about the issues that you're for?
Well, I don't really look at it that way. I mean, I've hardly ever written that way, but I did. I mean, before I knew what I was doing, I began in the late 50s simply to write about the lives of ordinary women around me. I mean, I didn't do that thinking, oh, I'm a feminist, I'm now writing about the lives of women. I really was already part of what was happening, but I didn't know it. There were people much more conscious than myself. But what interested me absolutely was the lives of women around me, and that's what I wrote about. And that was, in a sense, that those things are political acts. You know, you illuminate what's been hidden, and that's the politics. One of the politics of literature. One of the politics of some of the literatures.
When feminism started really being described as such, say in the late 1960s, and when consciousness-raising groups were developing mm-hmm. around New York and other places, did you feel like your life got changed in any direct way, or were you already living a life that you felt was in harmony with feminism?
Well, nobody really. I don't really know exactly what that means, but I'll try to answer it. Nobody lives a life in harmony, in a sense, with such a broad and deep and world-transforming idea. I just went on with my life. But as a writer, like a lot of women writers, I was corroborated by it and, you know, and helped. You know, your work, you do your work, and you may be doing it in the wrong time. I mean, you know, maybe you write these stories, nobody's going to read them for 50 years. So you're sort of lucky if you're writing these stories, and then people say, well, this is the time for them. But there are plenty of people who are, you know, who maybe are doing work that won't be read for a long time, or people whose people whose work was heard, you know, clearly in the 30s, you know, and then time, history, McCarthy, the wave of a certain kind of academic literature. Someone like Merida LaSur, who's a wonderful writer and who's old now, and who really has the women's movement, the feminist movement, has really just surrounded her with affection, interest, love, and gratitude for you know. And she spent years really, and so did Muriel Rukeyser too. I mean, there were lots of women who began to do this work in the 30s, and then got omitted in many ways, not entirely in Muriel's case, but omitted from literature and history and so forth for the next 15, 20 years. So it depends what you do and when you do it. Nobody lives outside of a certain their time.
Maybe some writers have felt a certain pressure on them when they do have obvious points of view on certain issues, a certain pressure on the people who agree with them, on the part of the people who agree with them, to express those views in their writing and to be, you know, right-minded and
oh, well, that's people have always done that. I mean, that's always happened. And I just if that's not what they're really thinking about, it'll show.
You were very active in the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. Looking back now, what are some of the things that you did that you feel were most effective?
Well, you see, nothing that anybody does is effective. You have to have a whole movement for things to be effective, and so that you do it as part of what's happening, and you play some. Everybody plays some sort of role in it. For instance, people feel that the collapse of the armies in Vietnam really is what brought about the end of the war. I mean, of the American army, the refusal more and more of men to fight, and that certainly is true. But that couldn't have possibly happened without a sense of tremendous support at home. And I think that was one of the things that I was most interested in at the time. Was in supporting in every way the resistance to the war, both in and out of the army and in the military, certainly. I think that was really very useful. Little task. Mm-hmm. But the thing was to really stay with it, because we really began in 1961 or 62. My friends and I, in something called the Village Peace Center, and it was really before the war, and we began in response to the bomb tests and the strontium in the milk. We had small young kids, and we were very interested in that. And then the war came along. But there were times when there were, in the early 60s, 63, 64, you know, you'd have a demonstration with 18 people. So one of the main things is really to stay with it, you know, and give your task some fidelity.
What are the issues you've been most concerned with recently?
Well, I've worked on a number of things, but right now I'm working on a women's action at the Pentagon. Lots of us feel really that we're living on what can be called a precipice, and that there's really not much not much hope unless people really move together and begin to express in great numbers the same kind of rage and refusal that we did during the anti-war movement and civil rights movements too. I'd like to read a statement, if I may.
Sure.
Yeah. Is it all right?
This is a statement.
This is a statement who? That that the women who are working on this wrote together.
Okay.
And I'd like to read it to people. It really tells you what we're doing. And it's also an interesting document because a lot of people wrote it together and worked hard on it to make it very clear and add things to it. As a matter of fact, I'm supposed to add something to it, which I already can't remember what it is, but I'll read it to you. We're gathering at the Pentagon on November 17th because we fear for our lives. We fear for the life of this planet, our Earth, and the life of the children, who are our human future. We are women who come in most part from the northeastern region of the United States. We're city women who know the wreckage and fear of city streets, country women who grieve the loss of the small farm and have lived on the poisoned earth. We're young and older, we are married, single, lesbian. We live in families, as students in dormitories, and some are single parents. We work at a variety of jobs. We are students, teachers, factory workers, lawyers, farmers, doctors, builders, waitresses, nurses, poets, engineers, home workers, electricians, horse loggers. We are all daughters and sisters. We have come here to mourn and rage and defy the Pentagon because it is the workplace of the imperial power which threatens us all. Every day while we work, study, love, the colonels and generals who are planning our annihilation walk calmly in and out the doors of its five sides. To carry out their plans, they've been making 3 to 6 nuclear bombs every day. They've accumulated over 30,000. They've invented the neutron bomb, which kills people but leaves property intact. They will produce the MX missile and its billion-dollar subway system, which will scar thousands of miles of our western lands and consume its most delicate resource, water. They are creating a technology called stealth, the invisible, unperceivable arsenal. They've appropriated $20 million to revive the cruel old killer, nerve gas. They have proclaimed Directive 59, which asks for small nuclear wars, prolonged but limited. They're talking about a first strike. The Soviet Union works hard to keep up with United States initiatives. We can destroy each other's cities, towns, schools, children, many times over. 5 other countries now own at least 1 nuclear bomb. France will produce the neutron bomb. We're in the hands of men whose power and wealth have separated them from the reality of daily life and from the imagination. We are right to be afraid. At the same time, our cities are in ruins, bankrupt. They suffer the devastation of war. Hospitals are closed, schools deprived of books and teachers. Our black and Latino youth are without decent work. They will be forced, drafted, to become the cannon fodder for the very power that oppresses them. Whatever help the poor have received is cut or withdrawn to feed the Pentagon, which needs about $500 million a day for its murderous health. With this wealth, our scientists have been corrupted. Over 40% work in government and corporate laboratories that refine methods for destroying or deforming life. The lands of Native American people have been turned to radioactive rubble in order to enlarge the nuclear warehouse. The uranium of South Africa, necessary to the nuclear enterprise, enriches the white minority and encourages a vicious system of racist oppression and war. There is fear among the people, and that fear, created by the industrial militarists, is used as an excuse to accelerate the arms race. We'll protect you, they say, but we have never been so endangered, so close to the end of human time. We women are gathering because life on the precipice is intolerable. We want to know what anger in these men, what fear which can only be satisfied by destruction, what coldness of heart and ambition drives their days. We want to know because we do not want that dominance which is exploitative and murderous in international relations and so dangerous to women and children at home. We do not want that sickness transferred by the violent society through the fathers to the sons. What is it that we women need for our ordinary lives, that we want for ourselves and for our sisters in new nations and old colonies who suffer the white man's exploitation and too often the oppression of their own countrymen? We want enough good food, useful work, decent housing, communities with clean air and water, good care for our children while we work. We expect equal pay for work of equal value. In our old age, we expect our experience and skills to be honored and used. We want health care which respects and understands our bodies. We want an education for children which tells the true story of our women's lives, which describes the earth as our home to be cherished, to be fed as well as harvested. We want to be free from violence in our streets and in our houses. The pervasive social power of the masculine ideal and the greed of the pornographer have come together to steal our freedom, so that whole neighborhoods and the life of the evening and night have been taken from us. For too many women, the dark country road and the city alley have concealed the rapist. We want the night returned, the light of the moon special in the cycle of our female lives, the stars and the gaiety of the city streets. We want the right to have or not to have children. We do not want gangs of politicians and medical men to say we must be sterilized for the country's good. We know that this technique is the racist's method for controlling populations. Nor do we want to be prevented from having an abortion when we need one. We think this freedom should be available to poor women as it always has been to the rich. We want to be free to love whomever we choose. We will live with women or with men, or we will live alone. We will not allow the oppression of lesbians. We do not want to be drafted into the army. We do not want our young brothers drafted. We want them equal with us. We want to see the pathology of racism ended in our time. There can be no peace while one race dominates another, one nation dominates the others. We want the uranium left in the earth given back to the people who tilled it. We want a system of energy which is renewable, which does not take resources out of the earth without returning them. We want those systems to belong to the people and their communities, not to the giant corporations which invariably turn knowledge to weaponry. We want the sham of atoms for peace ended, all nuclear plants decommissioned. That is another war against the people and the child to be born in 50 years. We want an end to the arms race, no more bombs, no more amazing inventions for death. We understand all is connectedness. The earth nourishes us as we, with our body, will eventually feed it. Through us, our mothers connected the human past to the human future. With that sense, that ecological right, we oppose the financial connections between the Pentagon and the multinational corporations and banks that the Pentagon serves. Those connections are made of gold and oil. We are made of blood and bone. We are made of the sweet resource, water. We'll not allow these violent games to continue. If we're here in our hundreds today, we will certainly return in stubborn thousands and hundreds of thousands in months and years to come. We know that there is a healthy, sensible, loving way to live, and we intend to live that way in our neighborhoods and on our farms, in these United States, and among our sisters and brothers in all the countries of the world.
My guest is Grace Paley, if you're just joining us, and she writes short stories, which she was just reading for us as a statement written by a group of women for an upcoming march at the Pentagon. When is the march, Grace?
It's on the 17th, and there's a gathering in Washington on the 16th of all these people, and if you're interested in joining us, the number to call in Philadelphia is 386-4875, which is the Mobilization for Survival. That's 386-4875.
You were telling us that statement that you just read was written by a group of women. Were you in on the
yes,
writing of that?
Yes, yes, yes.
Now, what was it like for you, since you are a really special writer, and I don't know who the other women were or what their special talents are, but you're not used to sitting with a collective and figuring out
what didn't really write it. What we did was we wrote about three different versions of it, and then I sort of took it home and worked on it, and then I got a lot of telephone calls from people in Amherst who are very active in this, saying what changes should be made, and then people left notes all over the place, and then there was another two meetings at which people made comments and criticisms, and I must say, and all of them very good, and added things and subtracted others. And in general, I found that a wonderful experience for me, and a very important one.
That's interesting, because I know a lot of people have basically given up on collective processes when the collective is really large, because it takes so long to get something done.
Well, a thing like this, which is long, started as 1.5 pages, and it happened over a period of meetings. The first draft is quite unrecognizable. It was just the basic thing, and we worked from that. And I think what worked well was sort of one person sort of holding it in her hands for people to work against and for. I think that was one reason that it probably worked in a better way. But it was wide open to everybody to put their 2 cents in there. You've dollar been, and a half cent.
You've been helping to organize marches since like 1962 or something?
No, I really haven't worked in organizing of that kind. I really worked very locally. I worked mostly in the Greenwich Village Peace Center almost all the time, and then I worked in, and through that in Resist, and which had very little to do with Washington Actions, although I would go to them, but our major work was local. And in a sense, this is a Northeast regional one, so that there will be, we've been meeting with a number of people from both Mobilization and AFSC and other groups in Philadelphia. I mean, I haven't been meeting with them, so I don't know exactly who they are, although that's the number I have to give you. But even there, within that Washington, within the fact that we're going to Washington, what we've decided to do is really take this Northeast region, because we've been working with the people in New England. I've been living up there a lot, mm-hmm. and there are people coming from Vermont and New Hampshire and Maine, and a lot of people from the Connecticut River Valley there in Amherst.
You've been in big marches before, right?
Yeah.
Oh, how do you like the feeling of being in a big crowd all together for a cause, or does it make you uncomfortable to be in such a crowded area in spite of the cause?
Oh, no, I don't mind. I think two things happen. First, everybody should work locally. I mean, people should work really in their neighborhoods. I know people who are really not afraid to go to jail, but who are really afraid to knock at their neighbor's door. So I think it's very, and in a way, it's more scary to knock at your neighbor's door sometimes. So I think that those are the really important things. The really important thing is the local work. As for the big things, that's the way we know each other's numbers, because one of the things the government really tries to do is hide us from each other, so that you don't know that there were tremendous demonstrations in Austin, Texas, about a half a year ago. You know, that's just kept out of the papers, or that there's a group working very hard in Tucson, or, you know, all of that. And you don't know what a tremendous European movement exists, and it's getting bigger and bigger, you know. That's the wonderful part of coming in large numbers, of coming together. You say, oh, yes, you know, there are a lot of us. So that's really very good. But the great thing is to work. It's never to forget to work where you are.
The march at the Pentagon seems to be mainly focused around nuclear weapons, but the issues included range from acceptance of gay rights, having streets to be safe at night so that women can walk.
Well, it's really a woman's document, and we feel very much that the violence that women suffer in their lives. And I say women suffer that violence even if they're not. If you don't go out after 9 o'clock at night, I don't know what Philadelphia's like. If you don't go out as soon as it's dark, you're suffering violence. I mean, you're really being repressed, kept out, and so forth. We feel that violence, that street violence, the violence that we hear more and more about in the home of battered women, we feel that violence really comes from a philosophy and of dominance, and it is really encouraged by the military emphases that are getting bigger and bigger in this country and are really scary. And we think the Pentagon is the center of that. It really is the.
Do you expect the people in the Pentagon might find it easier to dismiss the rally because there's issues in there that they'll be quite sure they have no control over, like rape in the evening?
Well, this statement is really addressed to other women. I mean, what we really want is to have a much. I mean, this is we're all in process, you know. So that's why when you asked me before, what did I think we'd done that was good earlier?
Yeah,
it's all process. So what we look forward to is simply organizing. We think this is not real and natural subject historically, and always has been for women.
There's a reference to pornographers in that statement, and I know you were in the founding group of Women Against Pornography. As an artist, is there a lot of gray lines there for you?
There's a lot of gray lines for a lot of people. And it's real, and I think, and the people, and the women. I'm not working with them now, although I talked to a lot of them, not just a couple of weeks ago in New York. And they, They themselves have gone through various through a process of thinking about problems about the First Amendment, and also thinking about differences between pornography and erotica. And a lot of them are artists and are very sensitive to this subject. I mean, they don't take it lightly, which some people think they do. They're very serious about it, and they are trying to really develop consciousness and theory around it.
Where do you stand now? Do you think that certain pornography should be censored? Or
no, I don't believe any. See, I'm not for censorship. I don't believe in stuff like that. On the other hand, I do believe in action. I mean, some women went into a pornographer's shop in Hartford, Connecticut, and poured blood on unconnected breasts and thighs and so forth that were hung all over the place. Terrible. Not, you can't even call it objectifying of women. It's just it is of women's parts, you know. And so they did that, and they tried to call attention to what it was all about. And it was a big case, which they won.
What did they win when they won the case?
Well, what happened is that they really they poured blood all they were arrested, and I don't remember what the charges were, but they were very serious charges because the guy pressed the charges who ran the shop, and they fought their own case. They did it pro se and won. And there were a number of charges against them.
What do you think violent pornography and some of the violence in horror films where women are getting slashed up indicate about what people are thinking in the country?
I think there's a terrible, there always has been an awful misogyny in this country. I mean, there really has always been a lot of anti-woman feeling. And and as Andrea Dworkin's book is called Women Hating, and it really, there is a lot of that, you know, and plain and simple, you know, and you're really surprised because I'm always surprised when I meet it. I speak as though I believe it, but I'm surprised again and again. I mean, I was someplace out in California, I don't want to say where, and I was in a school, college, where out of a department of about 35 guys, there were two women. And so I just teasingly said, what's going on around here? I mean, haven't you ever heard of affirmative action? I mean, you guys asleep at the switch or something, you know? And then they began to tell me all kinds of reasons that they couldn't really hire women. And I was stunned by them. You forget again and again, and I was really stunned.
What did you do? Do you find that logic works in a situation like that?
Sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. See, because I think there's a kind of a backlash, if you want to call it. It's not a backlash. What it is is just a pulling back of the wave, you know. And all these little bugs are coming out from under that wave as it pulls back. And that's what's happening. So that all these guys, who thought they had other opinions, are really finding out that they didn't. I mean, they really always thought that women tried to get ahead in a college department by flirting and sexually and so forth. Uh-huh. You know, and they always thought that really women tended to have babies as soon as they got, the minute you gave them tenure, you know, they really believe all that stuff, and they didn't say it for a long time, but they're beginning to say it again and again, and the films that are coming through now are just part of that same pulling back of the wave, and those are the big, really horrible bugs that are coming out, Dressed to Kill and stuff like that, you know.
Do you remember?
Badness. Yeah.
Do you remember about 10 years ago when everybody was going to see karate films and mm-hmm. you'd be driving in your car down the street and there'd mm-hmm. be kids doing karate moves on one another who mm-hmm. had never studied karate, but they'd mm-hmm. seen it in the films. And it was a phase that came and went, more or less. There aren't nearly as many karate films. They've been right now replaced by horror films. But every few years, there's a violent trend that seems to take over. It becomes a genre unto mm-hmm. itself, and every theater has at least mm-hmm. one of them, or maybe a double bill. And that's replaced by another trend in, mm-hmm. in violence. Do you think that what we're seeing now is just another trend and it's going to
I think it's part of a of something that we really have to respond to. I think it's part of a I guess I'll stick to my little metaphor since I can't think of a better one. It's not such a hot metaphor either, but it's the one I'm stuck with. I really think it's part of the pulling back of a wave. And, you know, we may get another wave going in the next 5 or 10 years. But it's part of an anti-woman thing. It's really the same thing as what happened with blacks and black studies.
On
the other hand, I must say that among young women that I know at schools, there's a lot of easy confidence that is very nice. So that I feel that what the two things are happening, that young women are growing up into a period where it's natural for them to have a very large degree of self-respect and feeling for one another. It's just sort of, you know, while the other thing is happening. And also that a lot of young men have been wonderfully affected by the women's movement. And you see some amazing young fathers. I think the women's movement has been one of the most important, probably the most important movement.
You have two kids?
Yeah.
What are their sexes?
One of each.
As someone who's been really active in the women's movement, do you feel comfortable with their attitudes towards male and femaleness and male roles and female roles?
Yeah.
Good. Because I know some women now with like young boys who are really worried that somehow media images and things that they're inadvertently learning on the streets are going to make real chauvinists out of them.
Well, I think that boys are a little bit like that at a certain point. I mean, your children, no matter who you are, I mean, are not brought up by you. You know, women have always had that burden of specializing put on them so that the kid is, whatever happens to the kid is mostly their fault. But really, the society brings up your children, and it's your time that says, well, this generation of kids is going to have to crawl over the barbed wire fences of drugs and war, you know, so who isn't going to get scratched and torn up by that? You know, you can bring them up in the most delicate, sweet manner, but they've had to go through that. There was no way around that for a certain generation, and they were ripped up by it, and no mother or father could have saved them, you know.
I don't mean here for you to draw the line and define yourself, but in terms of your political interests and your work as a writer, does either have priority in your life or are both very important and you give time to both of them?
Well, no, they're both very important. I mean, I see my life. I don't think in terms of career or anything like that. I'm a writer, and I'm a person, and I'm a woman, and I live now, and I hope that the world lasts. For my new grandchild, I hope that little girl, you know, grows up. I sometimes think that, you know, if she grows up, if she gets to be 5, 6 years old, then maybe the world will last. But I really feel that it's our responsibility to see that kid and all the other kids get through this next terrifying period. So I'm a writer, and I do my work. That's my work in the world. Both those things.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, it's really been so nice to meet you and to speak with you this afternoon. I want to thank you for taking some time out of your busy day to come here.
It's a nice opportunity to talk to people.
I've been speaking with Grace Paley, who's a short story writer. Now, she has two volumes of short stories. Her first is called The Little Disturbances of Man, and her second is called Enormous Changes at the Last Minute, and I believe they're both still in print.
Yes.
Now, she's also published recently in the New Yorker magazine. Do you have anything coming up in the near future to alert us to?
No. I publish in other magazines, too. I mean.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah.
Now, the march that she was talking about, by the way, is November 16th and 17th at the Pentagon, and a Philadelphia number for the mobilization of survival, which is participating in this and can give you any more details, is 386-4875. So that's 386-4875. And what brings Grace Paley into town today is a writing course at Temple University Center City, which is bringing in guest writers. She's here today and was here last week, and before the week before that, Tim O'Brien was brought down by this course. Well, again, nice to have met you, and thanks for being here.
Thanks, Sue.
This is Fresh Air. It's 25 minutes to 4 o'clock, and you're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. In just a couple of minutes, Judy Stein will be here to review museum and gallery shows around town.